Welcome, listeners, to the latest edition of The Inside Track. My name is Richard Goldman. Today's guest on The Inside Track is Marcia Goldstein, partner in the Business Finance and Restructuring Department at Weil, Gotshal & Manges, and a member of the firm's Management Committee. Marcia has practiced at Weil, Gotshal for over 40 years in all areas of domestic and international debt restructuring and crisis management. Marcia's career, as one of her colleagues put it, boasts a litany of landmark cases and turnarounds that have become touchstones of the restructuring bar, including AIG, WorldCom, Co-opting Bank, Parmalat, Takata, General Growth Properties, and Washington Mutual. Marcia has also represented significant creditors and interested parties in other major debt restructurings and Chapter 11 cases, including Kodak, Arcapita, Nortel, Allied Federated, and Washington Group. Recently, Marcia was named to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the New York Law Journal and selected as the National Law Journal's 100 Most Influential Lawyers in America. In 2009, 2011, 2013, and 2015, Marcia was named one of the 50 Most Powerful Women in New York by Crain's New York Business, and in 2008, was named one of the 50 Women to Watch by the Wall Street Journal. In 2008, Marcia was named one of the two Women of the Year in Restructuring by the International Women's Insolvency and Restructuring Confederation. In 2004, the American Lawyer featured Marcia as a Dealmaker of the Year for leading the successful restructuring of WorldCom, and in 2008, for her leadership role in situations at the epicenter of the financial crisis, including Chapter 11 counsel for WaMu, restructuring advisor to AIG, and U.S. counsel for Co-opting Bank. Marcia is a member of the National Bankruptcy Conference, the American College of Bankruptcy, and the International Insolvency Institute. She has also been a leader of UJA's Bankruptcy and Reorganization Committee and served on the boards of Heard Justice and the Boys and Girls Harbor. She's also serving on the Leadership Committee for Tina's Wish. It is an honor and a pleasure to welcome Marcia to The Inside Track.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, happy to have you. So let's begin, and we'll start with some quick takes. In your opinion, what's the most challenging aspect of being a restructuring advisor?
Well, I think as many of my colleagues in the field might say, it's driving consensus. The restructuring of particularly a complex company with multiple and diverse interests is always a challenge. But one of the other challenges is having the ability to attract a company as a business matter early enough so that you can actually drive a better result. And I think sometimes when a company is suffering distress, they don't want to recognize it early enough. And if they do, they can retain restructuring counsel. And sometimes it's difficult to drive that opportunity early. Mm-hmm. If you're retained early, you have many more options for out-of-court solutions and are not necessarily driven to a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Not to say that there isn't potential out-of-court resolution later, but earlier, having more cash on hand gives a company at least a few more opportunities than if it waits until the last minute.
Right. I am sure that over the course of your more than 40-year career, your practice has changed significantly from, you know, more than one time to the next. But what is the most significant way in which your practice has changed over the course of your career?
Well, I think the most significant change is the change in companies' capital structures. And during my career, you had the beginnings and development of distressed debt trading. So I would say that I witnessed personally some of the very early cases representing, for example, creditors of storage technology in the 1980s, when it was the first time we really encountered debt trading, where some members of our bank group, and that's also a change, is the driving creditors were the syndicated bank groups.
Right.
But some members sold their claims, and it was, frankly, an intelligent investment by the distressed buyer because the creditors in that case did very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd say that that was something I witnessed as a change. And then, of course, it changed the practice, particularly as companies debt structures started to look a little different. First lien lending, second lien lending, more and more funds being part even of the initial lending group, as opposed to a bank-driven restructuring. So when I started, whether you were debtor's counsel, and we frequently were bank group counsel. Mm-hmm. I was a creditor's lawyer probably for the first almost 20 years of my career, representing agent banks, bank groups. But that piece of the practice, we still represent creditor interests here, still will represent, you know, a bank leading a syndicate when there is one. But that was a big change in the nature of the practice. So the creditor representations shifted. The debtor representation got more complicated with multiple layers of debt, and therefore more disparate interests to try to drive a consensus for.
What is the, in your opinion, the greatest strength as well as the greatest weakness of the U.S. restructuring system?
The U.S. restructuring system is the benchmark for other countries to date. Many of the changes in our system that we've seen over time, which are generated by special interests, detract from that a bit. Mm-hmm. But it is still the benchmark for other countries who are looking to upgrade their bankruptcy systems or achieve a bankruptcy system that is not necessarily driven to liquidation or a long administration. So the fact is we have the fresh start concept. We also have the concept of, you know, equality among creditors, and it goes beyond going after preferential transfers or attacking fraudulent conveyances. Even the confirmation of a plan in which a majority, not a strict majority, but two-thirds in amount and 51% number can bind other creditors, there's still standards. Mm-hmm. Equality of treatment within a class. Creditors still have the right to object. But the drivers lead to fairness in how the restructuring is applied. And at the same time, perhaps one of the weaknesses is that, you know, anybody can come in and object. And so you can have potential litigation, but it's also a strength in terms of, you know, allowing parties to be heard. So it's still the benchmark.
As you think back over the course of your career, what role, if any, do you think luck had to play?
Well, luck always has a role. I don't care who you've interviewed before. If they said there was no element of luck, they were overlooking something in their life. Luck's been a big factor for me. Even coming to Weil was somewhat a piece of luck. Many know the story that I took my husband's slot for the interview because I didn't want him to be punished in the school system of, you know, if you don't show up for an interview, then you can't interview, you know, for X period of time. So when I was at Cornell Law School, my husband was at Cornell Law School, and he couldn't make the interview. So I said, it's really not a problem because we were married at the time, and he's Mark Goldstein, I'm Marcia Goldstein. Yeah. So I went to the interview. Even though I hadn't signed up for it. So I'd say that's an element of luck. Choosing restructuring as a career, in the 1970s, that was not something people talked about. Now, law students are very interested in restructuring. Business students are very interested in restructuring. You know, when I went to law school, there was a debtor-creditor course. That was about it.
Right.
And a covered bankruptcy and secured lending. And, you know, it was very, very different. So the choice of the restructuring as my field came after I interviewed at Weil. I met people, and I made maybe an instinctive choice based on people I met. And there's one other element of luck. Coming into this practice at that time, now, are you in the right place at the right time?
Right.
Was a piece of luck as well, because I joined, you know, late August 1975. The bankruptcy code that became effective in 1978 was in the works. So we were looking at it. Harvey Miller was, you know, one of those who was involved in commenting on the statute. So I learned the statute at the get-go. Hmm. And, you know, was able to be very early to an expertise.
If you had to choose a different profession, if perhaps law did not work out, what profession do you think you would have ultimately chosen?
It's hard to say, since even going into law was just maybe an accident. So that's another story. But I think that, you know, maybe something in the finance world, but I really don't know. As I said, many things, you know, in the 1970s when I was in law school, graduating from college and in law school, law was not the first on my mind. It was also a time where I didn't really care for the job options upon graduating from college. So I went to law school after my junior year in college when a program was announced, and I asked my college advisor, what do you think? And he called up the SAT people and said they have a seat for you, the LSAT people, and they have a seat for you in about a week. So different today.
Yeah.
So I can't even answer that question.
Let's take a little bit more of a step back, learn a little bit more about, you know, your childhood development. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn.
And tell me about, like, your family and that.
I was the first of my family to go to college. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother worked. My father worked in the post office. So it was when I said I didn't want to go to a local college, you know, that was kind of a shock to the system.
Mm-hmm.
I had done always very well in school. I was a top student in my high school, and I wanted to go to an Ivy League college. And there weren't that many options then.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, and a friend of mine from high school, her father took her to see Cornell, and so I went with them.
Right. And what was
my parents didn't take me on a college tour. So I went with them. I liked it. There were the only other Ivy League school really, you know, for women, not for women, but that admitted women at the time,
right,
was University of Pennsylvania. And I thought, and you know, it would be nice to get out of Brooklyn. Ithaca, New York was a beautiful, you know, bucolic environment. So while everybody today is trying to get into Brooklyn, I actually was trying to get out of Brooklyn.
Right.
And, you know, went to, you know, quote, a country school.
Got it. And what was your experience there like?
You know, I had, there's always an adjustment period in college. I was very young. You know, it started right after my 17th birthday. And, but I liked it. It was a wonderful experience. And, you know, I got a great education. I had a great opportunity to go to law school after my junior year to work with a government faculty. I was a government major, faculty member, on a book about the Supreme Court, which enabled me to have credit in both, you know, the college and the law school, and, you know, and thus enabled me to meet some of the requirements for that. So it's something that I met my husband there.
Mm-hmm.
My son went to Cornell. He met his wife there. So, you know, there's family tradition, all good traditions. So I would have to say it truly shaped me as a person, just being there.
Did you start Weill directly out of Cornell Law School?
I did start Weill directly out of Cornell Law School. I was 23 years old.
Did you have other options that you were considering as well? I mean, obviously.
Yes, other law firms. Yes, I went and interviewed with a number of law firms. And
why Weill?
Well, that's a good question. I knew somebody at Weill from law school who was here and, you know, spoke highly, and he happened to be in the restructuring practice. But I also knew somebody at Sherman and Sterling and other firms, and so I made the choice based on the people I met and where I thought I might like to, you know, practice law. In the 1970s, the guidance we had about law firms was this loose leaf that was kept at the law school, which was published, you know, each law firm put something in there about themselves. The social media didn't exist. American Lawyer didn't exist. So it's not as though we had a lot of data, information about firms. You had to be somewhat relying on your instincts and the people you went to law school with who might be at the law firms. And that's how I made my decision.
Right.
Another element of luck, perhaps.
There you go. I think you mentioned before that, you know, when you joined Weill, or at least when you left law school, restructuring was not necessarily on your mind or perhaps not a choice. So how soon after joining Weill, did you start considering and think perhaps, you know, restructuring was what you wanted your practice to be?
Well, it's interesting because Weill, in one respect, hasn't changed since that time. When you were hired, they wanted to know where to put you immediately. And so there was some interest in having me in the corporate department and some interest in having me in the restructuring department just based on who I met and also who interviewed me at school, a restructuring lawyer. And there was, a desire on my part to, I had some interest in litigation, but not a complete interest in litigation. Some interest in corporate transactions. And so this is a practice that combines that. And that's still something we talk about to young lawyers who are making a decision about our department. The range of transactions and opportunities to gain courtroom experience is truly unparalleled. And I didn't even fully understand it at the time I joined the firm, but I like the idea. And it has been true, in terms of your skill sets are much broader. So that's where I ended up.
It is it's very rare, I think, these days to see someone who has spent their entire career right at the same firm, whether it be a law firm, a financial advisory firm, an iBank, what have you. Yet for more than 40 years, you have called Weill Gotshal, your professional home. To what do you credit your uninterrupted tenure at the firm?
Well, I think, I fit in, pretty easily when I started. I had friendships among the associates, but more importantly, I had Harvey Miller as a mentor, which, at the time, I didn't realize as at the get-go, how significant that was, but over time, I certainly realized that. I had been doing well at the firm, so I made partner when I was 30 years old. I started when I was very young. So the firm was a good place for me. It was also a place where I had a lot of opportunities to build my practice and build my reputation. And so it was a continuum for me. And while maybe more so than other firms traditionally, and I know things have changed that over the years, was a homegrown practice here. Mm-hmm. And there are a few of us still left from the times I was, an associate, not too many. But essentially, I'd say until recently, we were primarily homegrown.
Right.
We've had to, as you lose people over time, we've had to, fill in the ranks and develop additional and new leadership, and we've done that.
Perhaps Harvey Miller, who you just mentioned, is the answer to this question, but if not, interested in knowing who would be the answer. Of the many professionals, for and with whom you've worked, who would you say has had the most impact on your professional career?
Clearly, Harvey has had the most impact on my professional career. He required a degree of excellence that I think made me a better lawyer. Mm-hmm. He also was about reputation building, and so I not only was he important in my having those opportunities, but I learned from him about writing and speaking and being, taking prominent roles in organizations, and also mentoring is beyond legal practice. It's, how do you develop business? And, I think I took a lot from him there, understanding that the contacts you make early in life, early in your career, are going to, grow and become, in many cases, the senior people you're going to deal with later. So I think overall, I was fortunate to sort of step into an opportunity, and I took advantage of it.
Right.
I think that's my part of it. And I think that is why I've had a long career at Weill. I think it's been to my advantage.
Yeah. I want to pivot a little bit and discuss issues concerning women in bankruptcy and restructuring and the development and growth of women in the space. You enter the bankruptcy bar, as we said, you know, back in the mid-70s during a time when the practice, I'm sure, you know, was dominated by men. What kind of challenges did you encounter specifically as a result of your gender as you were breaking through, you know, into this space and as you were sort of encountering and having to deal with, you know, people who had already been here, many of whom were not women?
All that is true. And just give you further context, when I joined the firm, it was not the firm it is today. It was maybe 140 people. And I've tried to count a few times how many women there were in the firm when I joined, and maybe it was five or six. My entering class, interestingly, was 50% women, 3 out of 6. Mm. But that was dramatic.
Right.
It was truly dramatic. And, you know, I was the only one that came into the restructuring practice. So, yes, there were challenges. I think that I'd go to a meeting with Harvey, for example. I won't mention names. It wasn't somebody in this firm, but would just refer to me as Honey in the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that still happens, though, by the way. Not
right.
To me.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I held my own. I just said, don't call me Honey.
Right.
Somebody, you know, who would come out of a meeting, see me in the hall, and think I'm a paralegal. Mm-hmm. I looked very young. I was very young, you know, when I started at Weill. But, you know, you have to, you know, say, no, I'm the lawyer, you know, working with Harvey on this or that, you know, because it all related to these meetings. And, you know, that particular lawyer, you know, he and I are still pretty good friends.
Okay.
And he's retired a number of years because he was far more senior than me.
Right.
But somebody run into still. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the minor things. I think the more, and I think those things, I think, don't occur as much. I think that if you look around the practice of restructuring today,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to say that it's still driven primarily by men. And that's 40 years. And so you have to ask, what is wrong? Women are naturals. We get good legal training. We do well, generally speaking. As well as any man in terms of, you know, credentials and, you know, what holds us back.
Right.
Because we're also just naturally inclined to, what do women do historically in the households and the families? We drive consensus. We handle all the emergencies. We solve crises. That's, women have been doing that, you know, probably for thousands of years.
Right.
So there's the need, I think, for women to both receive more opportunities from the males who run practices, senior women, which includes myself, and I do, must mentor younger women, but women also need male mentors because there aren't enough female mentors,
right.
Which is what I'm saying, there's something wrong here because in the 1980s, in the late 80s in particular, you had many, many more women coming out of law school. So there's still a boys' club. I think it's for some women, you know, harder to break, and maybe for some it's easier to break into that. But I think you need to have more men who are willing to mentor and spend time with and provide opportunities for the women they work with.
Okay.
It seems to be more natural to do that male to male.
Right.
And so I think that has to change. And, you know, I think women, I mean, I'm not the only, you know, senior woman restructuring lawyer around, but there are only a handful.
Right. Many listeners of the Inside Track podcast series, both men and women, experience difficulty finding the work-life balance in the world of big law. It's a constant problem that I'm sure has existed for decades and decades. The challenge becomes more difficult as attorneys build families, build lives outside of the office. You know, their priorities change. How were you able to find your work-life balance, and what advice can you offer to those who might be having difficulty finding theirs?
Work-life balance is a problem for men and women. I think that has changed from the time I started, because it was much more of an issue for women. But I think over time, men recognize as well that they have needs in terms of spending time with their children. And I think that is a generational difference from the senior lawyers that were here when I started at Weil Gotshal to, you know, the leaders of the firm today. So I think we're talking work-life balance for both men and women. But from a woman's perspective, you need the right spouse and the right help. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, had a full-time nanny live in until my son was, well, I don't know. I don't remember when I got tired of that, but let's say 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And then I had, you know, a day help. Also, my husband, who was also a lawyer and a trial lawyer, you know, there's a competing career issue. And you have to do as much as possible to make things work for the two of you. So in our case, living in the suburbs was out of the question.
Right.
And I still make these recommendations when people talk to me today. You need to be near, you know, near the school, near the pediatrician if something happens, because you are a professional. If you have to leave for an hour, you know, you leave for an hour and deal with it and come back. Also, when I say the right spouse, I think that you have to have a spouse who puts the two careers on equal footing. So, you know, if the nanny didn't show up, you had to review who had what to do that day and who was going to stay home. It wasn't presumed always to be the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that generationally speaking, I think it should get easier. It's never going to be easy to balance that. Especially, I only had one child.
Right.
And there were challenges in that. We couldn't go to everything. At least one of us went to, you know, various school events. When my son was playing sports, I said to my husband, that's you, to go to, you know, those things, even though I would have liked to have gone. But,
right.
You know, you have to decide.
Mm-hmm.
I think that many of the my male counterparts in my generation had non-working wives. Well, that takes a big lift. That's a big lift for the family.
Right.
And, you know, so I think that's why the burden was always more on a woman professionally and generationally, more so in my generation, I think.
Let's pivot topics once again and talk cases, specific experience and anecdotes of your time as a restructuring attorney. I want you to recall back to the first case, not the absolute first case, but the first case where it was your time to finally run the show, where you were the lead attorney in charge. What case was it? Who were the other professionals working with you? What was that experience
like?
You're
talking about like? A long time ago.
I know. It's.
And then, you know, what does it really mean to be, it was my first case in charge.
You felt where it was, you know, your time to run the show.
You know, when we were a smaller practice then, so as a senior associate, I was, you know, running cases.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's less likely. I'm running cases, but, you know, Harvey might have been the senior partner on the case, but, you know, he was doing something else. So I got to run day-to-day cases early, maybe even earlier than, you know, some of the, you know, senior associate excellent attorneys that we have today. But one thing that struck me as a senior associate, when you say when was that responsibility handed over? Harvey always took his vacations during Thanksgiving, by hook or crook. That week was his vacation, no matter what. And there is something to be said for predictability. However, you know, clients and, you know, case opportunities are not equally as predictable. So I had mentioned Storage Tech, which was a case in the 80s, and we were retained by Citibank, the agent bank, as creditor counsel. And it was myself and Harvey. But then Citibank said, look, you have to get retained by the whole group. So this is an important meeting. It's going to be in San Francisco. and it was going to be the week of Thanksgiving. And Harvey calls me and my corporate colleague, who was the same year, and the retired chairman of our firm, Steve Danhauser, into his office. We're both going to come up for partner like that year.
Mm-hmm.
And, quote, "I'm not going to this meeting. I will be on vacation. You two go out there." Because either it was going to be a Chapter 11, which is what happened, or it's going to be some transaction, and then Steve would work on it. But if you don't come back with the business, don't come back. So the pressure was on. Steve and I went out there.
Just a little bit.
You know, we had the support of the agent bank, who mm-hmm. certainly knew me from prior cases, and got to know Steve. And we came back with the engagement. And so while I had been running things, you know, day to day prior to that, I'd say that was the first time I felt my career was on the line.
Right.
Although maybe not really, but a pressure to go to a pitch, essentially, and win the case.
Right.
Now, it may not have been as competitive as other pitches, but the pressure was still there, and it was a very big case.
Yep.
And it was a case that I did run in the Chapter 11, which filed in Denver shortly after that meeting. So it was an interesting case.
Let's fast forward a little bit. In 2002, you became the co-chair of Weil's
yes.
Business, Finance, and Restructuring Department. Your 13-year tenure in that role spanned the financial crisis and its aftermath. What was it like serving at the helm of arguably the most prominent, you know, bankruptcy department, certainly the most prominent debtor side bankruptcy department in the U.S. during the Great Recession?
Well, that's another pressure. I think that, look, we were extremely busy during that period. So on the one hand, I didn't have to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
It did happen.
Right.
And it was an effort by all of us and Harvey. We filed, I think, 21 cases in 2008.
Yeah.
That's a lot of cases. Now, I think we may have filed 21 last year, too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the exact number, but we had a good volume of cases last year as well without a financial crisis. But that was an extraordinary period. We all worked on multiple situations, and it was quite intense, particularly at the beginning, you know, when we were – I went to some early meetings with Harvey on Lehman, but then I got a call from the general counsel of AIG, and so I diverged into counseling there. And that was counseling resulting in the federal loan
right.
to AIG. And that was very tense.
Right.
And then ultimately we restructured the federal loan
mm-hmm.
to make it more company friendly.
Right.
In that instance, federal government was fully paid back. GM, which was also going on, the federal government was fully paid back. I also represented General Growth in that period, which is second largest mall owner, and some other real estate cases as well. But General Growth sticks in my mind because it was filed clearly as a result of the financial crisis. It was a solid company, good cash flow, but it had a number of properties, mall properties, all in separate companies, and, you know, tied up with mortgages and CLOs, which could not be refinanced. It was a company made for Chapter 11.
Right.
I mean, in a sense, Chapter 11 enabled us to extend those mortgages at good rates. The result was and we also did some restructuring at the corporate level. The result was a no creditor received less than 100% return, perhaps just on extended terms, and equity had a very good return. So Chapter 11, I think, showed its true usefulness in a distressed situation enabling a company to preserve its inherent value. And I think General Growth was a great example of that. So that was something I worked on during the financial crisis as well.
Right. Perhaps it's one of the cases that you just mentioned, or perhaps a totally different case, but which case in your career would you define as the most challenging restructuring?
Well, you know, they all have their own challenges, and so I could pick WorldCom for that. You know, it was a crime scene when we got started, largest, you know, fraud in corporate history. Literally, the FBI had taped to the CF, you know, it looked just like they tape a murder scene.
Right.
And so it made it that much more difficult for us to really quickly, because we had to very quickly educate ourselves, you know, on the financial situation at the company, learn enough about the company to get it into Chapter 11 very quickly. Because once that kind of fraud gets out in the news, the company has no access to credit. So that was a challenge, and we also had to preserve assets globally. It had many, many global subsidiaries, and hard decisions were made, making sure whatever cash the company did have supported the global enterprise. And so in that sense, it was a very successful but case as well, because the company survived. After the bankruptcy, it was acquired by Verizon, but at least for a good price.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that had challenges and a success story at the end of it. WorldCom was, of course, the owner of MCI, and the global business customer network was something Verizon didn't have.
Right.
And it was a very, in that sense, it was a very interesting early example of a company that had established a systems practice, in the sense, or systems business. The internet, for example, the Social Security Administration or Department of Defense was set up. Those contracts belonged to MCI WorldCom. And so it was a gem for somebody to acquire.
Mm-hmm.
But we let it get restructured first, which I thought from a value standpoint was a success. More recently, Takata. Was a success in a different way. Yes, the company got acquired. And so perhaps from the equity standpoint, they didn't have the result that a GGP had. But from the standpoint of satisfying a Department of Justice order in a timely way and creating value for creditors where there may not have been any, and getting a situation which covered both victims, toward victims, as well as covered the needs of the car manufacturers from a safety point of view, so that they could have a continued flow of airbags.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a success.
Right.
And that we finished that earlier this year. Now, on challenging cases, I mentioned only debtors, but I'm currently representing a debt insurer in the Puerto Rico situation. And that is a challenging situation because you're dealing with governmental entities, an oversight board, and it doesn't have the traditional attributes of transparency that you find in Chapter 11, where parties just decide or figure out, you know, what's the pie, how do we restructure it. You have to look at very different issues here. There's a lot more litigation as a result, and a lot more political angles. So I would say from a challenging case perspective on the creditor side, that is one of the most challenging as well.
Yeah. A couple of final questions to conclude today's podcast with. When you're not in the office, when you're not answering emails, phone calls, you know, practicing law, what are some activities, hobbies, philanthropies, you know, that you like to participate in?
Well, I would say that cell phones and email means that you're always doing those things.
Sure.
I do have interests outside the firm. I always have. I have separate friends from my work colleagues, which I think is important to have some separate social aspects to your life. Always been interested in art and travel, and I am an attempted golfer.
Okay. A lot of experts in the distressed field are thinking about and looking forward to perhaps, you know, the end of this cycle. Not looking
for,
well,
way to put that.
From a business development standpoint, I guess, to be fair, at least on the advisors, not the investor side. But, you know, the next cycle or the end of this cycle, you know, potential future recession, the impact of looming trade wars, the impact of tax reform law that was just implemented on distressed companies. What are your thoughts, you know, of what the next 12, 18, 24 months hold for the restructuring space?
Well, I think it is an interesting fact that at least we and maybe one or two other, you know, firms with big restructuring practices, mostly one other, are very busy. We're very busy right now, and we're not in a default cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So we would expect, you know, there have been a lot of debt issuances. Some of the big banks have predicted recession in 2020. How early in 2020, or whether it's the end of 2019, or whether something crazy happens because of our government situation here in terms of trade wars or other things that could occur. So I think we should brace ourselves for a downward change, and it may not be immediate, but I think we just haven't even seen a raised level of defaults yet. Cases we've seen in the last 2 years are event-driven. Retail is because of, you know, the forces of technology, perhaps, not keeping up, and other reasons, obviously. And then various sectors, oil and gas that would have a result on the service businesses of oil and gas, so a helicopter company, for example, leasing company. I think that, and also we've done other municipal bankruptcies besides Puerto Rico. So it's hard to say what to look forward to, but I do think that there will be more and more pressures that will keep us busy. Our pipeline for 2019 is busy.
Mm-hmm.
We just filed a few cases in the last week, more to come. And again, I think it will get worse. Well, will is a strong word. The thinking is it will get worse.
Right.
We don't know. Something can happen on the positive note. But we've gone a long time without elevated defaults. And so most people are expecting that to occur at some point. We just don't know when.
Okay. Final question for the podcast today. It's the same question that I used to conclude all of the Inside Track podcast interviews. What is the key piece of advice that you would like to offer young practitioners in the distress space?
Well, and also the most difficult question, but I do give a lot of advice to young practitioners, and what I do say is obviously try to be the best lawyer you can, but also try to build your reputation as you're doing that. If you're a good lawyer, you should be able to write articles, you should be able to ultimately become active in some organizations, even writing for our own bankruptcy blog, our associates get a byline, and it's well read. And I think there is a lot when you're young to build some reputation so that people recognize your name. And also those reputation building activities make you a better lawyer because you're learning and you're doing. And take advantage of any mentorship you can in that regard. And also with respect to ultimately learning how to build business. And as I mentioned before, I think your early contacts are important, building friendships. I said I maintain friendships outside of my work world, but you also have friendships that you develop inside of your work world, and those are important too, because ultimately you want to help drive business in your practice.
Well, that is all the time that we have for the podcast today. I'd like to again thank Marcia for joining us and sharing with us the stories, the events, the obstacles, the successes, you know, that define your career. We always appreciate the candor as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Until next time.